Emer McBride is one of our most innovative and exciting writers. Her first novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, won the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. She followed this with The Lesser Bohemians and Strange Hotel. She has now written a new essay called Something Out of Place, Women and Disgust. And I'm delighted to say Emer McBride joins us now from London. Emer, you're very welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Excellent. The book has titled Something Out of Place. It's about women and disgust, but what or who is out of place? Is that women you're talking about?
Yeah, well, I think it comes from the idea of Mary Douglas's, who's an anthropologist, that, you know, the things that we regard with disgust are often things that aren't disgusting in themselves, but if they're in a place where we don't think they belong, they become disgusting. So a piece of cake on a plate is not disgusting, but a piece of cake on the toilet floor is very disgusting. And I suppose I've taken that idea and used it to think about the way women are treated so often with disgust. Women's bodies are treated with disgust, and I think that is often because they are seen to be in places where traditionally they were not supposed to be and remain unwelcome.
So is it about how women's bodies are presented, or is it about, let's say, the biology of women's bodies?
I think it's about all of these things. It's about the way that women are socialized to think about their own bodies. It's about the way those bodies are treated in society. And I think it's also about the way women are kind of reared to internalize a sort of a self-hatred and a sense of self-disgust and unsurety about themselves and an inability to live comfortably with their own bodies. And that's, you know, it's a system of thought that surrounds us, very hard to get on the outside of.
And do you see that all the way back to the womb, or do you see it more beginning in puberty?
Well, of course, we know that in some cultures, for instance, in India, where they have a son preference culture, female fetuses are aborted in the womb simply because they are seen as of no value. So I think it comes from, you know, it comes from that. It also comes from the ideas that, you know, girls are supposed to, are reared to kind of, to be there, to be helpful, and to give way to boys, to support and to understand, to hold back for themselves. And then, of course, once you get into puberty and the way the bodies change, and, you know, and it's an uncomfortable time for every adolescent. But, you know, I think the way girls' bodies change into women's bodies is treated with a kind of a terrible kind of disgust. The natural function of the body is seen as something to be ashamed of, to be hidden, to be excused. And of course, how can we then, as grown women, how do we make peace with our bodies, and then the way that our bodies change continually throughout our lives in very dramatic ways, in ways that men's bodies, you know, really don't change with the same kind of force. And so I think it's a problem that comes all the way through, right from conception to, you know, right the way through to menopause, and the way that older women's bodies are treated with disgust, or older women's sexual desires treated as something laughable and embarrassing. It's you know, it's a system of thought that plagues us.
Yes,
eternally.
Yes, and throughout the essay, something out of place. You continually look at it, how women are looked at from the outside, but then how women internalize those feelings and objectification they get from outside, and what effect that has about their own feelings about their body.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, it's something that I've explored in my fiction, particularly in Strange Hotel, about, you know, the way women are reared to constantly view themselves from the outside. So it's not simply that we have to, you know, hold our own with our own thoughts and feelings and our abilities to, you know, to take on an argument, but we're also reared constantly to wonder how we're coming across, if we're acceptable. And it's, you know, it's very, you know, maddening for women to spend and to waste so much time and energy on this kind of constant sense of self-doubt and of second guessing. And, you know, I think, you know, men clearly aren't reared to do this and don't do this in the same way. And, you know, it's a problem that we need to, you know,
To go on about that objectification, you then make a distinction between the words meat and flesh. Can you tease out those different words? Again, it's similar to the beginning of the argument you're explaining there, that idea that the male is often considered to be flesh, whereas women objectified are seen as maybe a piece of meat.
Yeah, I mean, I think women being seen as a piece of meat is something that, you know, pervades our culture, but it's also it's a useful way to think about objectification. How do you tell the difference between a serious conversation about women's bodies or women's sexuality, and something that's being created just for titillation or for pornography? And, you know, men are regarded as flesh, and that is something that is sentient, and that has an internal life and a humanity to it. Whereas I think women are very often just viewed simply as meat, who, you know, and their internal lives are seen as uninteresting, unimportant, and also completely separable from their physical selves, so that it's all right to treat women's bodies any way you want, because there's nothing going on inside there of any matter, because this is meat, whereas, you know, I'm flesh.
So this is an essay, this is an argument, this is a polemic, but it's also full of really interesting and surprisingly unknown examples in many cases. So would you give us the example of the gonzo journalist Lester Bangs and what he wrote about Debbie Harry? This is back in the late 1970s.
Yeah, so, you know, this was written at a time when, you know, Blondie was kind of the world's number one band, and Debbie Harry was probably one of the most famous musicians in the world, most recognizable women. And Lester Bangs was hired to write a fan biography of the band. And throughout the book, he constantly refers to Debbie Harry as a girl, but at the same time mocking the fact that she was older than her other bandmates. But really, you know, the crux of the story is a section where he writes about how, you know, What would most American men do if they could get this woman, this dreamboat, kind of down off the screen and into their bedroom? What would they do with her? And his contention is that they would beat her up, because, you know, she might be up there on TV all high and mighty, but she's really just a piece of meat like the rest of them. And it's a story that. It's still, I know that Debbie Harry is still, I've still read recent interviews with her still being asked about that question and what he said, and the fact that he was at that time supposed to have been a friend of hers. And, you know, everyone who's read the book has commented on that particular anecdote and how incredibly shocking it was. And also the fact that nothing happened, that, you know, he assumed that it was all right to say that, and he was right to assume that it was all right to say that, because it was, because nothing happened. It wasn't edited. There was no outcry. And it, you know, continues to exist out in the world. And it's a really, you know, horrifying story about, you know, the way in which a man views a woman and the vengeance and the rage that he feels towards her for being up there on TV high and mighty when she was really just a piece of meat like all the rest of us women.
She may be up there all high and mighty on TV, but everybody knows that underneath all that fashion plating, she's just a piece of meat like the rest of them. So Obviously he was pushing her into whatever hemisphere he puts all the other women of the world in as well.
Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, even if you're beautiful and fated and famous and talented, you're still just a piece of meat. So there's, you know, if there's no way out for Debbie Harry, what hope do the rest of us have?
Now, when you read that, you think, oh, maybe that's back to the gender wars of the 1970s, and he was still out of pace with what was changing in America. But then, of course, you fast forward to Donald Trump, and you would have thought that he grabbed them by the pussy would make him not be president of the United States. That didn't have an effect on him either.
No, it didn't. And you can see all along the theme of meat and flesh in Donald Trump as well, how the way he constantly tries to return women's bodies to a state of animality, you know, that all the names are like, you know, pig and horse face and, you know, schoolyard child insults, but insults that are always about turning women back into animals as something that is, you know, that has no meaning and no existence and have no value outside of what their body could be for him.
So social media and reality television have upturned traditional media, and now it gives individuals a chance to make it big by uploading videos or selfies or photographs of themselves. Perhaps one of the most successful examples of this is the Kardashians, Kim and family, who have become multimillionaires. Let's have a listen to them in action, because you'll talk about them shortly.
No, but I had my trainer came this morning and we worked out.
You're not that athletic, though.
Whatever. You're not dedicated like these Kardashian girls.
Kardashian girls hit the gym heavy.
I gotta tell you guys something. Kendall was born with abs and biceps. Like, she had little muscles.
Right, but guess what?
Little muscles.
She's born with genetics? That's not fair for us. We have to work for ours daily. Kendall eats burgers and doesn't even do anything. And look at her.
She's a supermodel.
I do things, though.
Supermodel. Mm-hmm.
When people are confident, I know I could beat Kendall or Kylie's ass any day of the week. Just because she could climb a rope because she's a skinny bitch doesn't mean anything.
I don't have any backup here. I can do anything.
I know.
I think that's the difference between Jenner Kardashian is that we're not afraid of anything.
Yeah, I don't do heights.
Like, afraid of heights. I don't do heights either.
Me and Kylie we're down for literally anything.
There's the Jenners and the Kardashians fighting it out over their bodies in keeping up with the Kardashians. You talk about the Kardashians because I suppose the Kardashians inhabit that middle ground between, are they self-objectifying or are they really using their bodies and what they have to, you know, become multimillionaires?
I mean, I think they're kind of an interesting example because obviously they are women who have created enormous businesses for themselves. But that is not the story of the Kardashians. And it isn't the story that they want to tell about themselves particularly. And their brand, that horrible phrase, is all about creating a particular kind of womanhood, acceptable womanhood, sexy and desirable to men. And I think I think, you know, their rise to prominence came at a very sort of fallow time for feminism, and they became a very useful stick for the patriarchy, really, to beat women with, which was, you know, this kind of false notion that in order to be self-respecting, to have love for yourself, to take care of yourself, you have to spend all your time trying to create this perfectly feminized, acceptably feminized version of yourself. And I think it's been a big distraction technique used by the mass media in the last 20 or so years, really, to take women's eye off the ball, to create this kind of false feminism, which is still feeding back into constantly recreating these objectified images of what women should be.
Right, but you do say later on that, you know, there are even people like you or other feminists have to question themselves about if women, let's say pole dancers, say it's a way of self-expression. People on social media want to dress, or young people want to dress in a perhaps sexualized way, and they say that is the way they want to dress. So it is a contentious a middle ground, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think that this is this area of sort of double stagnation, which is, how do we do things which we find empowering, but which look objectifying? And are we making those choices freely, or have we been sold a puff into believing that this is what emancipation looks like? And how do we navigate the ground where we allow women to be and do what they want, but also not police them and risk making the female gaze as kind of onerous on them as the male gaze is? And it's a really difficult one to get on the outside of, because, you know, women are rear socialized into these objectified ideals from the moment, you know, they open their eyes and look around in their cradles. And so how do we find a truly empowered sense of self that doesn't involve imbibing these images and recreating these images?
Yes, because you explored that idea of women being active players in their own objectification in the career of Samantha Fox. She was a topless model, and then she became a pretty successful singer. And you recall her career, and you say, can self-objectification, such as a glamour modelling, ever be an expression of female power or liberation? Can you answer that, or it's just a question?
I think it's neither a question nor does it have an answer. It's simply a statement of fact that in order to gain any advantage, you know, she grew up with a very working class background with limited educational possibilities. And she, you know, with the help of her mother, who was ecstatic about this, became a topless model at the age of 16, I think, and therefore gained access to the kind of life that she could never have had, which she, you know, speaks very eloquently about herself. And she personally has no regrets about the choices that she made. But at the same time, it's impossible to imagine that in 1983 or whatever year it was, a working class man would have been delighted at the thought of his son getting his penis out on the front cover of the Sun or the Daily Star or whatever it was. And so what do we do with these situations where, of course, women will make choices that are objectifying in order to have opportunities which they are closed out of. And the way to change it, of course, is to change the whole system. But that's not going to happen today or tomorrow, and it's not going to happen because I wrote this book. And what do we do in the meantime, and how do we navigate this very, you know, kind of difficult system that we find ourselves trapped inside of?
And load be the day when women get past a certain age and yet they want to dress however they want to dress. You use another interesting example is the former editor of British Vogue, Alexandra Schulman's article on 50-year-old supermodel Helena Christensen, who dared to wear a basque with a pair of jeans.
Yeah, well, again, this is the kind of the strange double stagnation of the problem is that, you know, Helena Christensen wanted to wear a basque to someone's birthday, and she did, and she got a whole article in the Daily Mail dedicated to telling her that she was too old to be dressed like that. And, you know, as soon as I saw that, my heckles rose, because I thought, well, why should she not wear whatever the hell she wants? And so it's, you know, and at the same time, Alexander Schulman is sort of writing about how, oh, this is, you know, it's all right for old men like Richard Gere who are having babies because it's clear that their, you know, fertility is still intact. And lots of kind of quite stupid arguments, though, that, you know, if a 25-year-old woman, for instance, had, you know, had to have a hysterectomy for whatever reason, would we be saying that she was no longer allowed to wear a basque? With, you know, it's the kind of inane arguments that get made to just hide the fact that, you know, there is a fear of women behaving in ways that they are not supposed to behave, that there are set parameters that we are supposed to exist within. And if we choose to step outside of them, we have to get slapped down and slapped down publicly. And sometimes that slapping down is, you know, is done by other women. And that's, you know, that is a difficult thing to get your head around and a difficult problem to solve.
Eimear, we know you as a novelist who enjoys doing such innovative work in like A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing or The Lesser Bohemians or most recently in Strange Hotel. What was it like then, you know, after going through, you know, that individual look at a specific woman's life? How did you approach the challenge of writing about women in a larger scale in this essay?
With a lot of anxiety and horror, I must say. it was very, very difficult. It was, you know, Welcome Collection asked me if I would come and write something for them. And, you know, many years ago, before I was published, I worked for a long time in Welcome Collection in their library as their kind of, you know, one of the admin staff, and so I was very, I had fond memories of them and was keen to do something with them. And so the idea of Disgust had been kind of hanging around in me for quite a long time, was the idea of, you know, is it just me? Is this a thing? But it seems to me that Disgust is a way of, you know, that a taboo is created around women that shames them. And it's a very effective means of control. And am I the only person who sees this? Is this a bigger thing? And I'd like to spend some time kind of thinking about it and investigating it. So that's really where it came from. But yeah, it's a completely different experience to writing a novel. And fairly stressful, I would say.
And are you dying to get back to novel writing?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, fiction is my home. And it was interesting to do this. It was wonderful to have the opportunity and to be asked to do something like this. But I don't particularly feel at home in it.
Well, we're delighted that you stepped into the world of essays. Something Out of Place, Women and Disgust by Emer McBride is published by Profile Books in association with the Wellcome Collection. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Irlo O'Lennard is one of Ireland's most acclaimed Shannos singers. Rising to prominence as a member of the Afro-Celt sound system, he went on to become a founding member of the Irish-American supergroup The Gloaming. He has collaborated with quite an array of artists, from singer Peter Gabriel to composer Donacha Dennehy, appearing in Donacha's opera The Hunger from 2016 onwards. And his collaborations continue this September with the Music Network tour, where he has teamed up with Harper and electronic experimentalist Una Monaghan, and as well as the cellist Kevin Murphy. Before that, however, Irlo O'Lennard can be seen live in concert this coming Sunday, August the 22nd, at the Pepper Canister Church, just off Baga Street in Dublin 2. Irlo's concert is one of two gigs taking place this weekend at the Pepper Canister. This Saturday night, the same venue will play host to Lisa Hannigan and her band. But right now, I'm delighted Irlo is with us. And Irlo, the Pepper Canister Church, we did a trad fest there not so long ago. It's a really intimate venue. Did you have that in mind when you were planning your repertoire for the evening?
Well, I didn't really. The promoter, Declan Ford, and my agent Una Molloy suggested to me that we would do this event. It's not actually happening within the walls of the Pepper Canister. It's happening outside, on the steps. And so quite a lot of it is a visual experience. So it's very unusual for me.
All right, so you're going to be on the steps.
Correct.
And then people can gather around. Is that Lower Mount Street or Upper Mount
Street?
Yes.
I'm sure it's kind of controlled.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know much about that.
Yes, yes.
I've seen some of the visual work. It's going to be quite something.
Now, tell us who you're working with on this show.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, when I was asked to do this, because of the circumstances many of us find ourselves in, you're sort of like a bus driver without a bus or something like that. So I reached out to some musical friends of mine, and namely Caoimhín O'Riola, of course, from the aforementioned Gloaming, and another great musical friend of mine, Matthew Nolan. I did a lot of work with Matthew with Trieb Cano a few years back, and he plays wonderful electric guitar with effects. And then someone else that I came across recently whose music I really adore, Ryan Molloy, on a composer and pianist. So, I'm trying something that I didn't try before.
So when you say you're a bus driver without a bus, does that mean you can't work together? So you're working until you come together at the Pepper Canister?
Well, we will be rehearsing. But my point really is, I suppose, that I think everybody's normal workflow with the normal people they might have worked with or their normal setups have had to change, have had to adapt. And I suppose I could have stood there on my own and do whatever one does on one's own. But I like making music with other people. So, and these were choices I made on the basis of the sort of experience I want people to have when they are sitting out there with these beautiful visuals and so forth.
Now, one of the tracks you're going to play is Tamhsiam Culla, and that's from your 2005 album, Invisible Fields. We were going to play some of it, but you might introduce us to it.
Well, Táim Siomhol is one of the great songs of the Seannós tradition. It's often sort of described as some sort of a lament, and then other times it's described as an aisling. It's a complex narrative. It kind of covers all those bases, but it's also a song that deals fairly explicitly with the idea of wanting freedom or the search for freedom, which is a common trope in 19th century song, in which Seannós is largely bracketed. I mean, there was singing before then, and you know we don't know a whole lot about it, but this concert's an opportunity for me to reach back into repertoire I haven't performed for a while, and then to reach forward into repertoire I haven't yet performed.
Right, I think it's a 6-minute track, so we'll play some of this Táim Siomhol. Táim Siomhol there by Iarlóid Leonard with Matthew Nolan on electric guitar. Ryan Molloy is on piano and Caoimhín Oirithealla is on fiddle. And they are all going to be performing at the Pepper Canister Church. And Paul Meehan and Geppetto are the people who are doing this visual presentation.
Paul Meehan, yes. The thing about it is it's as much a visual experience, I think, as a musical experience, because I've seen some of these visuals and they're going to be huge on those lovely flat surfaces of Pepper Canister, with that kind of whatever, it's like bat stone to my eyes. I don't know where they got the stone, but it reminds me of that kind of stone. So it's very reflective, and it's going to be spectacular, I think.
It sounds wonderful. You have been, last year you were in America, or were you in America and it lapsed into last year? Was it 2019 into 2020 you were in Princeton?
Well, I've had a relationship with Princeton since 2016. I went there for a year, and then I was teaching there for what they kind of call a semester plus, which is kind of September to the end of February. And I came home in March 1st, 2020.
And their interest in Seannós and traditional music comes from where?
Should I claim that for myself?
I hope you would.
Well, you know, I've been fortunate in that they have an interest in what I do. I have friends, of course, who work there. I've collaborated with quite a few people. Dunnocka teaches there. Dan Truman teaches there. Paul Muldoon teaches there.
Yes, I was wondering, had you bumped into him in the corridors?
Absolutely, certainly bumped into him.
With his guitar in hand.
And not only bumped into him, but collaborated with him and everything else. And worked more closely with Dan Truman, actually. And with the doctoral program in composition, I'm sort of there at their disposal in some ways, as a resource that they can write for, experiment with. And also I've done some actual teaching as well. So it's an interesting window into American life. I think I was over there when Donald Trump was elected. The night he was elected, I was actually watching a show in Princeton, and all of the many things that happened thereafter. And then, of course, I flew home with the COVID tailwind, not fully realizing, I think, how bad things were in New York on March 1st. I do recall sitting beside someone on the seat of the plane, and he did have a mask on, something I didn't have. But of course, it went bananas after that, didn't it?
Now, you didn't only collaborate with Irish people in Princeton. There was also Pascal Leboeuf. Tell us about him.
Well, the thing is that they have a fantastic composition department there, as one might expect, I suppose. And one of the people studying there they're all very accomplished by the time they come in to do their doctoral work. They already have established careers as composers, albeit that they are young. much younger than I. One of the men that I met there was Pascal, and he has been working steadily with me since then on a new top secret project that I'm hoping to release next year. It's taken
which
a long time.
Which will be an album.
Which will be an album, yes. Of, I hope, 10 works, and I've done most of it. I've done all of the writing, and a fair old chunk of the recording as well. Albeit again, I started it over there, and the rest of it I did in my home studio, with you know the usual carry on and files going back and forth. It isn't as unusual as people think. It's not just a COVID phenomenon. You know, people were doing that anyway, except that they couldn't do anything else. But yes,
and is the work very different?
I think it is. It's different. In some ways, it's different. I'm in it, so it's not that different, I suppose. People would say, "Well, that just sounds exactly the same because it's him, isn't it?" for me, it's very different.
Okay. And has it got a name?
It doesn't.
All right. Okay.
It has, but I'm not telling you.
I know, that's what I thought. I thought there might be limited information coming from across the table.
I don't mean to be that way, but he has been producing it for me. He's actually a very talented Pascal pianist as well, and he has Grammy nominations and so forth for his work with his brother, the LaBeouf brothers, in the field of contemporary jazz. But that's not to say that what I will be doing is contemporary jazz, because it isn't.
All right, I won't ask any more questions because I know what I'll get. We were talking there before we came on air about John Bowman's programme on Sunday, which was about Sean O'Rea, and of course, you as a very, very young boy knew Sean O'Rea in Coolay.
Well, I think to say that I knew him is a bit of a stretch, of course. But
yeah, well, you were what, 3 or 4?
Well, yes, I was about, when he died, I think I was about 7. I was 7. My parents knew him very well. My family knew the O'Rea family very, very well.
Because you came from a family of singers.
Oh, that's right, but we were literally 2 miles from each other. And my father was the local principal of the secondary school. Sean O'Rea arrived with his extraordinary level of fame and his charisma to a very small area of West Cork, and started to become very active in many of the things that my father was trying to achieve, but probably didn't have that missing X ingredient, you know, kind of a national profile. And, you know, people always say, of course, that Sean O'Rea has had pronounced effects on the music culture, both nationally, but he had local effects too on industry, on development in the area, our families knew each other very well. I, of course, was in the choir. That's how I encountered him first, every Sunday, and at practice, Clach the Choir, as we would call them, in his front room. And then subsequently, after his death, worked for a long time at the choir under Pather, his son.
And he not only transformed Coolay as well as transforming Irish music?
Well, I think he did. I mean, you know, it isn't a stretch at all to say that he did, because, of course, the Mass itself was a huge thing to give people. You have to think of Ireland in the 70s, a very Catholic country, and then to be allowed for the first time to express that, those beliefs in your own language post Vatican II was a huge thing. And, of course, who stepped in? Sean O'Rea, and wrote the O'Rea the Mass. I mean, it's a funny thing. I was at a wedding in Rome about 15 years ago, and I remember the chaplain came down and he said, would you like me to play something for the O'Rea the Mass? And so he knew. So it has travelled. But Sean had other effects too, I think, locally. I think he had a strengthening effect on the local musical culture. Which perhaps might have become, through natural processes, more dilute, or, well, even to say that is perhaps wrong. What I mean to say is that it would have gone its own way anyway. And he had an effect. He diverted rivers. He changed the course of what people would do. I'm one of those people, arguably. I mean, it's highly unlikely I'd be sitting here with you were it not for Sean O'Rea.
Yes, yeah, he opened the possibility of innovation.
All of that. I mean, people ask you about Sean O'Rea and innovation. He was innovating himself as much as anything, in my opinion. So you were observing a guy who was self-innovating. And in a sense, if you can imitate that, it's a tremendously powerful, catalyzing sort of energy.
Now, we can't end talking to Irla without you talking about the Music Network tour.
Yes, what would you like to say?
So you are on tour and it features harper Una Monaghan as well as the cellist Kevin Murphy.
Yes, you know, this tour was supposed to have happened 6 months ago. And like a lot of things, you know, it gets, you know, moved along. It's very exciting for me. We've been working steadily for a few months, collaborating, creating new works, re-representing stuff from the traditional repertoire. Una Monaghan, of course, is a fabulous experimental musician, also a traditional musician, electronics, the harp. She's also a very extraordinary person. I think she has degrees in astrophysics and... She's smart, clearly. I don't know what she's doing working with me. But Kevin Murphy then also is a wonderful, beautiful, lyrical cellist. I knew that he had these beautiful propensities to create these lovely moments for singers in particular. So I'm very much looking forward to that. That tour is happening. We've quite a few dates in September.
I shall give the details in a moment, but we have an exclusive, which is a piece of music. This is a brand new piece of music, just recorded, and it's getting its first play on radio, and this is Rail.
We show the Yotsa show your goddess. Mask Mohina Edila Mara
Railt there from Irlo Linard. Una Monaghan on harp and electronics and Kevin Murphy on cello. You say it's a Martino Diron poem.
It is. The words are a setting of his poem, Fuish of the Yotza. Beautiful meditation on the idea of finding peace in whatever you call home.
Lovely, Irla. Thank you very much. And you can see that trio on tour around Ireland from Wednesday, September the 1st. They will be appearing in all four provinces and even including one date in London over 2.5 weeks up to Sunday, September the 19th. Full details about the tour can be found on musicnetwork.ie and the Pepper Canister Church concert. That's on this Sunday night with Irla, and on Saturday night there's Lisa Hannigan, and they can be booked and more information got from selectmemory.ie. Selectivememory.ie. It's just past 10 to 8. The Spree Festival in Waterford normally takes place over a long weekend in August, but this year it has had to post-lockdown, it has a post-lockdown makeover with a month-long event celebrating the county's sense of fun and community spirit. Performers took to the streets of the city and the Waterford Greenway, with the final part of the festival taking place in the Waterford Courthouse with the premiere of Prism Spree. I'm joined now by Mark Graham, the musician, and Mike Leahy to tell us more. Mike, you've been building up to Prism Spree, which is going to be happening this weekend. Tell us what has been happening in the city and on the Greenway.
Well, I suppose like the word of the year has been reimagined. So like every other festival and performance company, we had to reimagine what we did. So we had, what we basically did was broke the festival into a month-long event, what we call it a season. And we what we did was we put 4 days of performance into the city of like 80-odd separate shows in various locations around the city of dance, music, performance of all shapes and colours. And they were all held apart almost to try and break down crowds. And then we, with the following week, then we moved out onto the Waterford Greenway, and like in a 40 kilometre long cycle, we had five locations and five companies each doing three shows per day. So there was over 60 shows then on the Greenway in the previous 4 days, just ended yesterday. So we've been very busy and it's been hugely successful for us.
Now, the Prism Spree, it's said to be a prism of light and sound. What will it look like and where will it be?
Well, it's going to be in the grounds of Waterford Courthouse, a beautiful building just beside the park here in Waterford. And the Prism, as the prism is a large kind of structure of loads of angles and shapes on it to resemble a prism. And to my kind of, I suppose to me, the prism became a metaphor because of that way of that, you know, that a prism takes light and breaks it into its component parts. So this was kind of like a space we were building for performance and the celebration of that idea of component parts that make up life as we know it, and probably the absence of performance and art as we've had over the last year and a half.
So it's going to be light filled, like a prism, or
yeah,
yes.
And different to, like, I mean, the prism becomes the centerpiece, almost like a sacred space where we can celebrate all these various aspects of light. So Mark has worked on the idea of breaking it into and different moods and different art forms and different performances, different instruments, which will all coalesce together to form this one kind of white light or this one kind of piece or I suppose experience has been missing for so much of the last year and a half.
Okay, Mark, that's where you come in. So you are a musician and you've also curated this
space.
Yeah,
I've composed the piece. It's a 45-minute piece. And one of the things that attracted me to working on this with Spree was the idea that over the course of this, we will get a dozen musicians to work on this. Nine of us will work on it for a 2-week period. So in a time where musicians aren't working as much as they usually do, the opportunity not just to work, but to play together, we're going to rehearse for a week together, and then to play to an audience is something that people, they relish this opportunity. And my relationship with Spree, I think Spree is a wonderful example of an art group in the community, and really in the community. In 2005, I worked with Spree and composed a piece for the launch of Cork City of Culture 2005. And as a result of that, I realised that I could combine two loves that I had, which were technology and music. And as a direct result of working with Spree, I went to Trinity College and studied an MA in Music and Media Technology and studied composition with Donica Dennehy. And that was through my work with Spree. I never would have put those things together had I not received this work with Spree. So it's a great joy to be able to move on and work on this piece.
So let's listen to a clip from Prism.
I am the gown that weave swallows all light. All existence bows before my stitches. My authority incubates cosmic hibernation. Even the prism doffs its capstone. Until a stitch rips, a seed twitches, and the epic begins.
That's a section there from Prism, which takes place at Waterford Courthouse from the 23rd to the 29th of August. So, of course, in COVID times, will the audience be able to go into this prism, or do they observe from afar?
In and around it, there'll be an audience of 200 people there every night. And who we were just listening to there is the poet Abby Oliveira, who's been working with me on these compositions. So it's great to have a number of different people from different areas of the country coming together to work on this. And that's kind of part of the idea of it, you know, that we can break light into its constituent parts, but we can also bring those constituent parts back together to create something new and create something engaging.
And Mike, is this a logistic nightmare trying to bring a crowd, have a big visual event and keep everybody safe?
I suppose it is, like, I mean, but we're all kind of used to it now in that sort of way. But I mean, normally kind of we would do these large scale, huge events with hundreds of participants and thousands of audience. So in this way, it's given us time to kind of concentrate, and we're dealing with 200 people a night. So it's a different experience, but equally valid, you know. And I mean, luckily enough, we've been very lucky that the Arts Council and Waterford Council have come along with us on this journey and supported us in this kind of break from the norm in these COVID times.
Mark, you've got tuba, violin, vocalist, spoken word, piano and percussion. That's going to make quite a sound.
It is. And there are also aerialists and dancers involved as well. So it is, you know, in the tradition of Spree being a spectacle company and street theatre, it's very much in that place.
Yes, because on Twitter today, I saw a beautiful piece with fidget feet on the Greenway, I think.
Oh, yeah, that was very beautiful. We were lucky enough to have them in the city crazy for their new show, Handful of Dreams, but then they did a site-specific work for us on a stunning location in the centre of the Greenway on Kilmac Thomas, like it must be a 20-metre-high viaduct. And they came and worked there for a number of weeks and talked to the local community and created this amazing show that came down off the viaduct and just talked of the history of the area. And the
absolutely. It was as beautiful as it was terrifying.
Yes, trust me, it was terrifying to watch.
Well, my thanks to Mark Graham and Mike Leahy. Prism takes place at the Waterford Courthouse from the 23rd to the 29th of August. More information from spree.com. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Mark McGraw was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan.